Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello, I'm Matt Kelly.
And I'm Matt D'Ancona.
And this is the Two Matts for the week ending January the 5th.
The first podcast of 2024.
Yeah.
What a year it's going to be.
It is, isn't it? What did we talk about, Matt?
We talked about a variety of apocalyptic scenarios.
Yes.
Try to inject a little
apocalypse
bit.
Apocalypse can come in a number of ways.
A little bit of wit and fun and, you know, hope into the otherwise despairing landscape. But I think we kind of concluded that if maybe the salient characteristic of the year ahead is going to be just the sort of the scope of the possible.
Yes.
It was the unthinkable.
Well, this was the theme, isn't it? That what a few years ago you would think was unthinkable has now become very,
much very
thinkable.
And maybe that's the title.
We should call it that. So
2024.
This is the Two Matts, episode 28, 2024, Thinking the Unthinkable.
Thinking the Unthinkable.
Enjoy.
Enjoy.
So, Matt, what are we going to talk about in this first show of 2024?
Well, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
And to all our listeners.
Yes.
Happy New Year and welcome back. And it's going to be an incredible year, not necessarily in a good way either.
Yeah.
You know, 4 billion voters going to the polls, more than half the world's population, and a whole series of really important decisions and moments and conflicts going on in the year ahead, which I hope we'll be able to at least discuss some of today.
Yeah, yeah.
And I guess the big one will be the presidential election on November the 5th in America.
Yeah.
And so I thought maybe we'd kick off with, just to get things started, a quick clip of Trump's latest intervention. If producer Ollie could give us a blast of that, that'd be wonderful. That's a very technical way to kick off what is a huge, monumental, historic presidential contest. But it's not unapt because we're all going to have to become lawyers this year.
Yeah.
Because so much of the Trump controversy between assuming he does get through and stands, wins the Republican nomination and then goes on to face, one presumes, the incumbent Joe Biden in November, is going to hang on legal matters. And you know, one thing I did not expect for late 2023, early 2024, was that I was going to have to find out more about the 14th Amendment.
Yes.
But, you know, we are, because Colorado Supreme Court and Maine Secretary of State have both invoked this amendment in order to try and keep Trump off the Republican primary ballot. Where does this come from? Well, the 14th Amendment was passed in 1868 to keep the defeated Confederates after the Civil War off ballots, right?
Right, right.
Actually, the reporter there didn't quite get it right, which is if you've sworn an oath of office to the Constitution, you can, and you then engage in insurrection, you cannot then stand for office. In an effort to try and keep Trump out of the the pit completely, they're invoking the 14th Amendment. Now, I'm a rule of law guy, so if the courts uphold this, then let's go with it. Yeah, but I was very interested. Bill Barr, who was one of the Attorney Generals under Trump and hates Trump, wrote a very good piece in the Free Press this week in which he said, look, actually the case for keeping Trump off the ballot on this basis is quite flimsy.
Right.
And one of the reasons for that is that the amendment sort of makes it unclear whether the authority lies with the states or with Congress. And it implies that there should be a criminal conviction of the office holder.
Of defence before you can then...
And, you know, Trump, although we all know he was involved in an insurrection, has not yet been convicted of that felony. He may well be, but, you know, he was cleared by the second impeachment scandalously. My hunch is that he will go to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court will knock it back.
And just looking forward beyond... So, say, imagine that he is withheld from the ballot. And, I mean, it's in many ways, that's even worse than him running.
I mean, again, as I say, it, you know, enough of a stick in the mud say, well, if the courts say that, then we should go with it. But looking at it in a kind of pragmatic way, keeping the runaway favourite, for all that we can't bear him, and, you know, I wonder if he'd like us, you know. We went to the Two Med Studio. There were two of them, both really good podcasters.
Great podcasters.
Very fine podcasters best. On both sides.
Some say the best.
I could have done it better.
Yeah.
You know. They were talking about something called Brexit. I didn't understand. Anyway, very nice guys.
Nice guys.
Nice guys.
The best guys.
The best guys.
Some
so anyway,
say.
We'll never find out. But you're right. If they keep this guy, who's now 60% of the competition, off the ballot, this is not necessarily a recipe for...
Well, if they talk about stolen election on an election that he was actually able to run in.
Yes.
Imagine what they'll say...
When he wasn't,
if he's
right.
taken off. You know.
I mean, it's the pressure upon... Although the judiciary should be free from social pressure, they won't be. And, you know, keeping him off the ballot will be... problematic, to say the least. However, that's just a sort of taste of what lies ahead, because between now and what will be a hugely consequential election with an unpopular and weakened Democrat incumbent, Joe Biden, we've got all these court dates coming up. So, you know, for example, he's still claiming presidential immunity. We know that the federal case on his insurrection stuff, it being brought by the special prosecutor Jack Smith, is heading for trial on March the 5th. Why is that interesting? It's interesting because the day after March the 5th is Super Tuesday,
right?
On which day 1/3 of all Republican delegates are selected. So, you know, already you're in. There's this sort of collision between the primary process and Trump's big trial appearances.
The legal process.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, one of the many weirdnesses about a very weird year is going to be that the trials are going to be the campaign.
Yeah.
You know, that's where the action's going to be. And of course, this presents a problem for Biden because, you know, he's going to want to run a routine, you know, do you really want to risk it? Think how far we've come campaign against a guy who every time he's indicted seems to do better and get more funding.
And I mean, as you've said repeatedly, and you say in this week's New European column, Biden doesn't get the credit that you would expect him to get for the progress, the real progress that America's made under his presidency.
Tremendous progress. I mean, on a lot of measures, mostly economic, Biden's had a very successful presidency.
Yeah.
You know, the withdrawal from Afghanistan was not his or America's finest hour. But in terms of just getting the country back on its feet, he's done very well. But I think what you're seeing, and this is a warning to Starmer, who we'll probably come onto in a minute, is that the damage that the populist right does to trust has a terrible impact upon progressive parties because Biden is not getting any credit for all this.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons for that is because people don't see a link between what governments do and the improvement of their quality of life. And actually, America, you know, America's ahead of us in this regard. Jobs are coming back. People are starting to feel the impact of inflation falling. You know, there is, in normal rules, which I think are over now and not coming back, Biden really ought to be steering towards a quite comfortable re-election, but he isn't.
Right.
So about this, you know, one can make no certain predictions. You know, this is going to be a very, very difficult, angry, race. And I, we've said it before on the podcast that the only scarier thing than Trump winning is him losing.
Yeah.
Because can you imagine, we're recording this on Thursday, Saturday is the third anniversary of January the 6th. That was after an election he clearly lost. What will it be like if he loses again?
Right.
You know, supporters have been planning for 4 years. The militias are growing. Yeah. You know, one just hopes that there is an orderly transfer of power, whatever happens. But the reason it's good to start off with this is that, you know, America is still the most powerful nation on earth. And it could well be about to go through sort of 12 months of total introspection, which will have huge consequences for the other things we're probably going to be talking about in this podcast.
Yeah. I mean, there's a massive question, which is democracy fit for purpose in the environment that we live in now? You said a moment ago, the rules have changed completely. Yeah. And the old rules are never coming back. You know, so what's the long-term consequence?
I think that the long-term consequence is that a lot of the things that have been a matter of convention will have to become a matter of rule.
Yeah, nailed down.
Yes,
yeah.
Because, you know, conduct of debates,
yes.
Appropriate language to use. What we do about figures like Trump who've been disgraced. I mean, clearly, in a sane democracy or republic, as America always likes to describe itself, a character like Trump should not be able to stand for re-election, but he almost certainly is.
Yeah.
And I think that this is very difficult for Americans to understand and to come to terms with and make peace with, because they venerate the Constitution so much. And the whole basis of American politics is we've got the Constitution, the rules make it clear. And what's horribly apparent is that the Constitution as written is not enough to safeguard the Republic against an autocratic populist entertainer stroke fascist like Trump. And now, I mean, one thing I think we need to do and carry on doing and never not do again is start to work on the basis that when people say something, they mean it.
Yeah.
So before 2016, we very much with Trump, oh, he's just a cartoon villain, he'll never do any of these things. So when he said to Hannity, Sean Hannity of Fox, in one of the Iowa town halls last month, you know, I'd be a dictator on day one, everyone went, oh, yeah, good old Trump. But then he means it.
Yeah.
I remember last year you read out that list of Umberto Eco's definitions of fascism, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, Trump,
tick, tick, tick.
Yeah. And a second term of Trump would be very, very difficult for the Republic to recover from, I think.
Yeah. So bringing it to these shores.
Yes.
Because that was the bulk of your piece this week. And when I read the phrase, I kind of went, yes. You said that the collapse in trust in British politics is analogous to the collapse of the economy in 2008.
Yeah. You
know, there's been an
ethical crash.
There's been an ethical crash.
Yes.
And of course, you know, you hear Keir Starmer talking very well.
He was talking this morning, in Bristol.
Yeah, very well about restoring trust in politics.
Yeah.
But talk is cheap. And any crash takes a long time
to recover
from. And you listed a number of points where
you could start.
You could start.
But it is a start.
Yeah.
And also, you know, one thing I do think is it's an asymmetric thing, the decline of trust, because populist right-wingers like cynicism. They want people to blame their woes upon judges and elitists and the wokerati, whatever that means, and immigrants,
right,
and not expect government to make a difference to their lives, actually.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're a progressive party, the whole basis is that, you know, communal collective action works, collaboration works. And so one of the injustices of all this is that Labour, paradoxically, is going to be the one that picks up the bill, if you like, for Boris Johnson and bloody Liz Truss.
Blowing all the trust.
And Sunak with his ridiculous Rwanda policy.
Yeah.
You know, and this the kind of burden on a prospective Starmer government is going to be crushing in that respect.
So what are the practicals? Because Chris Bryant has written about this, and you quote his book.
Well,
what are the practicalities?
I mean, clearly we now know, because Sunak has this morning, Thursday, announced in Mansfield in Nottinghamshire that he's working on the assumption there'll be an election in the second half of 2024, which presumably means October, November. I mean, it could go December, I don't know. But so Starmer now has a lot of real estate to fill.
Yeah.
And we know that he's not going to want to talk too much about the specifics of fiscal policy. So, you know, one of the things he could talk, and this is the point of the column, I guess, which is, you know, there are specifics, some of them quite granular, that you could do to improve kind of survey the regulation of public standards in this life. The Electoral Commission, the very complex tangle of bodies that are, that oversee public life in Whitehall and Westminster could be consolidated and so on. And these are things that won't cost any money.
It sounded a bit like the suggestion was, and this is a crude way of saying it, but like a sort of an overarching ethical police force.
With teeth.
Responsible to Parliament.
Yes, so, but only responsible to Parliament on a statutory basis. Yeah. Not. I mean, the thing that MPs will bristle about is the idea that anybody should sort of have authority over them who isn't a parliamentarian.
Yeah, but that's bullshit, though.
Well, I'm afraid we've passed that point.
Yeah, tough luck.
You know, too bad.
Since the expenses scandal, they've proven they're as rotten as the rest of
they've
us.
Had,
and we all need policing.
Here we are. I mean, that was 2009. Yeah. We're now 2024. 15 years. Sorry, guys. You know.
Yeah.
So I think that could be a good theme, because I think that he's got a lot of time to fill now, Starmer.
Yeah.
You know, and we saw him this morning, and there was some good lines in it, like "This is your year." I thought that was a nice line. But when he gets on to, "Well, we're going to fund everything from growth," it's quite alarming, because, as we've discussed before, but
that's going to take a long time, and it's hypothetical growth, isn't it? No one can pinpoint where that money and when that money's going to come in.
You know, he says, "Oh, we're going to be a radical government because we're going to have the most sustained growth in the G7." Well, says who? I mean, how can you possibly know that?
Yeah.
The other thing is that there's a slight cart before the horse problem here, which is, realistically, to get growth going, we do need a Keynesian moment. We do need an injection of investment. But he says, "I'm not going to get into big spending and taxes before we've got growth going." Well, good luck with that. I mean, you don't just get growth going by saying we're going to have, as every incoming government has since the 50s, a skills revolution.
Yeah.
And we need to improve productivity. Well,
But all of that is based back on, you know, it's a manufactured conceit based on Brexit. Saying we need a skills revolution because we can't import the skills that we had before.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, we can't bring in skills to make the economy work, so we're going to have to do it ourselves. But, you know, there is a bigger solution, which is, okay, well, let's rethink immigration completely and bring in skills to get the economy moving.
The interesting thing on this is, you know, the more I think about it, the more I think that question will be impossible. He may be able to get to the election without having done anything other than, "Well, we want a closer relationship too."
Yeah.
But once he's in, assuming he does get into number 10, once he's in number 10, it will be screamingly apparent what you just said.
Yeah.
That, you know, if we're not in the single market,
this is going to go on and
his
on.
His growth objective is meaningless.
Yeah.
And so I think that will be one of the most important and difficult identity crises of the first year.
His challenge is to find a way of presenting that solution as not a correction to Brexit. He's got to find a way of presenting the solution of re-entering the single market or whatever we call it as not, "Oh, we effed up at Brexit."
No, it can't be. It cannot be a relitigation of 2016 if you do that, then, you know, the Dominic Cummingses, the Matthew Elliotts,
then they've got
what they want, right?
Exactly.
So it's got to be. And I think, actually, to do him justice, I think that part of the reason that he's been sort of playing what you might call this gentle patriotism, which is certainly not nationalism, but it's a kind of, you know, singing "God Save the King" at the Labour conference and so on, is that he sees that as a gateway. You know, we're going to be a better country, and as a better country, we're going to be fit for a new relationship with the EU.
Right.
Rather than we're going to reverse a terrible mistake.
So it's a patriotic step to...
Yeah, and you know...
It's not a loss of sovereignty.
Not in the slightest.
It's an assertion of sovereignty.
We are a confident country, and therefore we understand that the countries that are confident in the modern world have to be interdependent, have to pool their sovereignty. We've been doing it forever, and we're going to take this first step, whether that's joining EFTA or the single market, I don't know. But that, I think, is the way to do it. But it's very difficult.
Yeah.
And we know, and we've discussed it before, you know, the Daily Mail will go berserk, the Telegraphs will go berserk. You know, it'll be against what we assume will be a more openly populist right Conservative Party will go berserk. So he's got to have real cojones on this.
Yeah.
I think the honest truth is we don't know. I mean, he's... look, the guy's in his quiet way played a blinder, hasn't he? He's taken a party from, you know, the absolute depths of electoral despair to the edge of office. One has to hand it to him.
You've got to remember that it's only, what are we talking about, 3 years ago when people were talking about a decade
of Boris Johnson.
Boris Johnson.
Yeah.
And not because of Boris Johnson, but because of Jeremy Corbyn.
Right. And so if nothing, I mean, if Starmer stood down tomorrow, he'd be one of the most important leaders in the history of the Labour Party. Right. So, you know, he's done something right. Now, that doesn't mean he's going to be a great prime minister, but jury's out.
Yeah,
that's the best I can do, really, on Starmer, because he is a sphinx when it comes to all this. And there are people quite close to him who will say, don't know.
What did you make of that phrase, which has been widely praised this morning, about a government that treads more lightly on people's lives?
I think that's a very thinly coded sort of olive branch to blue wall Tories.
Right.
I mean, the truth is that if you look at the challenges of the next 50 years... Actually, government is going to have to be quiet. It's going to have to intervene in our lives a lot.
The paradox of what he's saying is that there's a huge amount of work to be done to rebuild trust. There's huge. We can trot off the existential problems this country faces, and that is going to require a lot of government, not less.
Regulation of AI, climate change, which we can go and talk about in the second half, maybe. But you know, these are things that not to speak of the sort of glaring problem of inequality of a kind that is simply not sustainable.
Yeah.
But also, if you want social cohesion to continue, the level of difference between the very rich and the very poor in this country is just not sustainable.
Do you know what we should do, mate? And I'm saying this because I was about to say what they need to do, but we should do it as well. We should take this on the road, this podcast, and go to five or six different towns.
I totally agree.
And you know, maybe somewhere in the countryside as well, and do it with people, and try. You know, I've mentioned John Harris before, but
yeah, no, he's Guardian, a very. I just think he's,
you know, it's proper real journalism where you go out and you actually see stuff.
What would make a difference? What would
and
help?
Talk to people and try and get a real sense of what's going on in the country. You know?
I think the biggest change in my lifetime has been that even under Thatcher, there was a notion amongst enough voters that they would get a fair shake. And now, especially amongst young people, but you know, obviously all over, you know, outside the Golden Triangle of the Southeast, you know, lots of people who just have absolutely no confidence that they're going to get a fair shake.
Yeah,
you know, they have to work 60-hour weeks, turning two jobs, and they still need universal credit.
Yeah.
Now that is not a sustainable basis for the seventh richest country in the world.
Yeah.
To work. These are questions of a kind of profundity and ideological difficulty that Starmer does not want really to get into, but he's going to he or someone else is going to have to.
All right. Well, if you're listening and you would like us to come and visit your community and do the podcast from a village hall or a small theatre or something like this, or a school.
We'd love it.
We'd love it. So email in your suggestions to 2matts, that's the number 2, MATTS, at tnepublishing.com. And we'd love to hear from you.
On the road again.
On the road again.
That would be great.
To get back on the road.
We're already murdering tracks in 2024.
Yeah. Right, we're going to take a short break before Matt starts singing any further, and we'll come back in a minute.
In the interest of public safety.
We'll come back with more chat about what we think might be big stuff in 2024. Thank you for listening to The Two Matts, and if you like the kind of conversations we have here, there are loads more to be had in print and online at The New European. And I have got a very special offer for all listeners of The Two Matts. We are giving away copies of Alistair Campbell's Diaries 2023, which is a book we're publishing this month. It's fantastic diary, full of everything that's happened, all the people he's met, and anybody who's a fan of Alistair Campbell's diaries over the years know how brilliantly he turns them out. He is very much a latter-day Samuel Pepys.
He really is.
He is. So you can get a free copy of Alistair Campbell's Diaries 2023 worth £20 when you subscribe to The New European from as little as £1 a week. Or if you like getting the newspaper delivered to your door every single week, you can have that for just another £1 a week. And that's a 75% saving on the price you'll pay at the newsagents. To get this great offer, go to www.theneweuropean.co.uk/2matts.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
So welcome back. 2024, my feeling. So one of my things, I think the climate crisis is going to become more and more obvious.
Yeah.
Not just this year, but, you know, obviously on an ongoing basis. Yeah. And I was reading it in the New European, Nigel Warburton, our in-house philosopher, yeah, did a brilliant piece about how it's baked into us to assume that the future will be like the past, you know, and this is really a problem when you get material change coming around the, yes, corner, which is what's happening. And then in the following pages in our carousel section, one story from Barcelona where there has been a drought for 2 years, basically, and none of those great city fountains in Barcelona have been running for 2 years. And since June, all the citizens have been restricted to 200 litres of water a day, which is basically a small bath, you, yes, know, and it's getting worse and worse and worse. And then the next story, the Danube breaking its banks and flooding much of Hungary, you know, and people sitting there deluged in unseasonably warm and wet weather. And it definitely seems to be something that we've got our head in the sand about still, you know, yes, despite all the verbiage and the talk and the mantras and the marches and all of this stuff. These are real changes that are happening to Europe, you know.
Oh, massive. And we talked a lot in 2023 about border control and migration and the horrors of the Rwanda policy and the incompetence of the Conservatives and their awful language. Well, I mean, climate change means that population mobility in the next couple of decades is going to be on a scale,
yeah,
never seen before,
yeah,
in the world.
And Paul Mason makes this point as well.
Very well.
About, yeah, you know, well, the analogy he uses was the development of the nuclear bomb and, you know, yes, the fear of chain reactions of atomic warfare and stuff like this. But now a real threat of chain reactions of crises, yes, localized crises, but all netting together. Some wars, some climate change disasters, populations on the move, political disruption, the disproportionate growth of other nations, you know, and how that affects the balance of the global economy. And we could be going into a period of, you know, I don't want to sound too much like Cormac McCarthy and The Road, you know, but we could be going into a period of real apocalyptic change,
yes,
you know.
And it's very important as we're looking at 2024, and rightly so, because it's a very important year. But if you stop looking at the long term, none of the decisions and things that happen this year will mean a row of beans.
Yeah.
And in fact, the issue you're talking about, Matt, is in many respects the only one that matters.
Yeah.
Because everything else is subordinate to that. And I do worry. I mean, I was appalled as you were by Sunak backsliding on the net zero strategy the government has. But I worry also that Labour, under political pressure, will keep pushing back its £28 billion pledge on green investment. And you have to have the courage of your convictions on this if you want there to be a planet for your children and grandchildren to have.
I'm still the phrase that my friend, the editor of Clarín in Argentina, wrote about the election of Milei, where Ricardo Kirchbaum, and he summed it up by saying that the fear of the present was greater than the fear of the future.
Yeah.
And that is very true for all of us.
It is.
As a species, we are very good at turning away from big things that are down the road to concentrate on smaller things in the here and now. And I just wonder, how do we, you know, apart from these climate conferences and all of this business, they're talking shops. We all know they're talking shops, yeah. But there's something palliative about the fact that, oh, everyone's agreed to keep it down to 1.5 degrees rise. Yeah. It's bullshit, isn't it?
I think you need, I mean, there is no alternative to political leadership. You need political leaders to say what we've been saying, but better, you know, and put it in Lincoln, Churchill, JFK kind of language. And this is one of the things that has changed, which is that back in the day, leaders were not afraid of challenging electorates. There's much more followership now than leadership.
That's right.
And there are very few people one can point to, I think, in the global landscape who have that capacity to say, this is going to be incredibly hard.
Yeah.
And yes, you know, it's going to cost you money. And yes, it's going to be inconvenient. And yes, you're going to have to ditch your car.
Mm.
And last year was a bad year because, you know, ULEZ is not about, the ultra low emission zone scheme in London is not about climate change, it's about air quality.
Pollution, yeah.
But, you know, the Uxbridge by-election caused a kind of nervous breakdown in the Labour Party. You know, oh my God, you know, if we do this, then we might lose the election. No, you know, you cannot think like that.
And again, it's a different issue, but it illustrates the point, the row in how hot under the collar people in Wales got about the idea of going 20 miles an hour rather than 30 miles an hour. Now, I drive in London, and when that change happened, for about 2 months, you did think, God, this is achingly slow.
Hmm.
But now, if you drive at 30, it feels like ridiculously fast.
Yeah.
And then you think about, you know, the hundreds of people who are still alive today because they weren't killed in a 30-mile-an-hour car crash. And the inconvenience, you know, the 2 minutes extra it takes you on your journey to go at 20... All of those things make perfect sense. And no rational person, really, when you sat down and said, you know, in the great scheme of things, is this something that we are not going to do because we're so stuck on this 30-mile-an-hour nonsense? I think most people would say no. There are bigger things to worry about.
Absolutely. And actually, one of the things that we've become terrible at in the West, in free societies, is thinking long term.
Yeah.
You know, we just are terrible at it. And there's that, you know, the so-called effective altruism school that was rather besmirched by its association with Sam Bankman-Fried.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's slightly quiet at the moment. But, you know, they have a point about being good ancestors.
Yeah.
And treating people in the future as you would your neighbours.
Yeah.
But this is a way of thinking that is not commonplace. I mean, but we think entirely in terms of convenience.
Maybe
really.
This is something that Starmer could think about when he's talking about the lighter touch of government. But is there something on a more grassroots level where he could structuralize community change, you know, where pressure grew from the community?
I think so. And I mean, one of the things that I've heard sort of suggested at a very sort of MP level rather than minister level around Westminster a few times is that bring back national service. Pause, gulp, everyone goes, no. But make the National Service a year of helping with sustainability projects around
like
the
UK. Like a kind of VSO kind of thing.
Yes, and the payoff would be that you get a bit of a help with your student debt or apprenticeship money and so on. You know, you'd be paid a living wage while you were doing it. But it would actually bring people together at an early age into the idea that the big challenge facing the country is just as National Service used to be, it was national security, it was being learning the basics of being a soldier. The future requires every citizen to be green.
And engaged in
and,
the
and engaged and yeah, actually you know, and it would be something that I think a lot of people would enjoy, but also it would, it's the kind of thing that we just don't do anymore, which is mobilize national and indeed and international opinion around a single idea,
a sense of mission. We've talked about mission. This time again,
you know, and, it's, we're so marketized, you know, everything is to, even public services are now presented in terms of consumption. I mean, of course you emphasize waiting lists, of course. But waiting lists should be an aspect of your experience as a patient, not as a consumer.
That's right, yeah.
You know, I hate that idea that I'm a consumer of public services. Of course I'm not.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a user of them and through the tax system.
You're certainly a funder of them.
A funder of them, yeah, that's fine. But they're not fungible goods on the marketplace, or at least they shouldn't be.
Yeah.
And, you know, the internet has spoilt us because... You know, if our delivery of a book from Amazon is a day late, we act like it's a massive national crisis.
Yeah, I'm the worst at it. Honestly, it's now my reflex to order Amazon Prime.
I know, of course.
Even if it's for sale down the road, you know.
Right, but you're sitting there with your phone and you think, you know, shit, I need this tonight. And,
I wanted to buy a dartboard. You know, I was watching Luke
Littler. Of course, I bet a lot of dartboards were sold on Amazon. That would be a great data point, I bet you.
They're hard to... You go
Even
and look,
now,
you can't
get
them.
There are Amazon vans all over...
Shuffling dartboards all over the country.
for the people's Oompa Loompa. I mean, you know, God bless him. So thinking, you know, the oldest looking 16-year-old in the world.
By the way, I must credit James O'Brien for the most apposite comment on that, which was that he said, he tweeted, if this lad was an illegal immigrant, then the Daily Mail would be demanding his teeth were being carbon dated right now. You know, I mean, and they would.
That's brilliant.
You know, yeah, but they spent all year saying they're not teenagers, young men.
Yeah, come here to play darts.
Exactly. It was a great point well made.
That is very, very good.
Yeah.
So that's climate change. Meanwhile, back on the war front. Yeah. We go to Ukraine. Remember Ukraine?
Well, we're going to do a cover on it next week, I think.
Very good. Because, I mean, it's there was a very sad and testy interview with Zelensky in the New Year Economist, in which he said, maybe not everything is as fast as someone imagined. That was the translation. You go back to 2022 when the invasion happened and everyone was running around in blue and yellow and, Zelensky and everything. And... this is an illustration of what we were just talking about, the sort of attention deficit thing, which is it's less than 2 years ago. It's not been that long.
And it's still going on, worse than ever.
And worse than ever. And hey, you know, that's what wars are like.
Yeah.
This is the problem, is that we're so geared to instant gratification that everyone came together, the West and the free world, not the non-aligned South, but certainly the West and the free world, came together around Ukraine as more unified than at any point since 9/11. And everyone was, we helped Zelensky. We're not going to put boots on the ground, but we'll give him. And now, since October the 7th and everyone focusing, understandably, upon the Middle East, you know, we appear not to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time as an international community, because it's like, Ukraine, Ukraine, you know, he can do a deal. And yet again...
It's suddenly become grudging, hasn't it?
Here's
your money, but this is the last of it, you know.
And I remember very early in the crisis... saying, you know, and I don't always get it right, but this one I did, which was, we're going to sell them out, because we sold them out in 1994 when, in return for Ukraine giving up its nuclear missiles, we said, yep, you know, Budapest memorandum, any problems with your borders, you give us your nukes, any problems with the borders, we, Britain, America, will come to your aid.
Yeah.
We didn't give them NATO membership in the early 2000s. When Putin annexed Crimea in 2014, we went, tricky. We didn't give them a pass to NATO membership at the Vilnius summit in July last year. In the end, we always sell Ukraine out. And I get the arguments for a compromise and, you know, it's not realistic to drive Putin out to pre-2014 borders. But we acted like it was for the first 18 months.
That's
and you can understand why Zelensky is, you know,
what happened,
yeah, you know. And of course, Putin is sitting there, you know, running out the clock, hoping that Trump will win in November.
Yeah, well, this is the interwoven network of crises that
It really is. Yeah. And I suppose that brings us on to the Middle East. And it's interesting in the last few days, because before Christmas, we were very much talking about, you know, the crisis of October the 7th, and then the crisis of humanitarian disaster in Gaza with, you know, what civilian casualties now up to 23,000, I think, and very much focused on that. And would it escalate? And, it is escalating. Yeah. There's just no question.
But it seems to me, so here's my naive take on it. I can't see what Netanyahu's strategy is other than wanting to drive Gaza completely free of Palestinians. Doesn't he want them to pour over the border into Egypt? Doesn't he want them on boats to come to Western Europe? You know,
I honestly don't know. I mean, I think that you know, he has two contradictory tasks. You know, one is to eliminate Hamas or degrade its capabilities,
which everyone agrees is the right thing to do.
You can't eliminate it, but you can probably bring it down to the point where it's not a viable force.
Yeah.
But he also has more than 100 hostages still in Gaza. And he also knows that the minute the first phase of the military operations ends, he's toast anyway. I mean, the Supreme Court just, struck down his very dodgy judicial reform. So he's a kind of lame duck prime minister, and he's not covered himself with glory during this crisis, to say the least. But I mean, meanwhile, you see all sorts of things going on. So there was that, we're recording this on Thursday. Yesterday, there was a explosion in Iran near the burial site of General Qasem Soleimani, who's a very iconic head of the Revolutionary Guards Quds Force, and it was the fourth anniversary. At least 84 people killed.
Fourth anniversary of his assassination
by the US strike in Iraq, and more almost 300 injured. Terrible event, and no one knows yet who it was. But Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi's already blamed Israel, blaming the, quote, Zionist regime. And America and Israeli sources in the Wall Street Journal today are saying we have no evidence it was Israel. But you can see that in Iranian public opinion, it will already be baked in that it was.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, in the Red Sea, Houthi rebels are firing on American and other ships, naval ships, and that's causing problems. In the north of Israel, you already have troops being withdrawn from Gaza and moved up to the Lebanese border to fight with Hezbollah. So people say, will it escalate? It is escalating into a regional crisis. Yeah. And I think this is very worrying, because you already have to your point, Matt, you already have will there be anything left of Gaza at the end of it? You have very sore and isolationist Israel thinking no one cares about October the 7th. You have Iran on manoeuvres through its proxies, and America about to go in on itself.
Yeah.
This is not a very happy combination of factors.
No, it's a shitstorm.
It is a shitstorm. And I find it very hard to game out a good answer. I mean, obviously we all want a two-state solution. I mean, anyone decent and sane wants that.
Yeah, but, well, except there's plenty of people who present themselves as decent and sane who say, don't. No, that's not on anymore.
No, and I mean, I think Hamas is much more canny strategically than it's sometimes given credit for, because I think that it understood completely that, it doesn't want a two-state solution, and it understood that Israel would go berserk after the October the 7th attack, and it has.
Mm-hmm.
And so the prospect of a two-state solution is now worse than it's been for 30, 40 years, which is very bleak.
I'm very reluctant to say the obvious thing, because I don't think there's anything obvious about any of this, but isn't the closest to an obvious first step a ceasefire now?
Well, I mean, look, there's the endless row over nomenclature, right? Humanitarian pause, truces and all that.
Yeah.
Who doesn't want a humanitarian pause, right? You want to see fewer people die.
Yeah.
The problem is that where I part company with the sort of ceasefire party is when they think that a ceasefire is going to resolve everything and lead immediately to talks in Oslo or Geneva about how to divide up the area of Israel and the territories. And I think that that's naive, which is, of course, you want to see the scale of civilian casualties fall down, ideally to nil. But I don't agree with the argument that a ceasefire, welcome it was it be in a kind of humanitarian way, will lead automatically to lots of things. So yes, a ceasefire, but what then?
Yeah.
You know, what? Because clearly Hamas cannot be part of the next. The only reason to lobby for a ceasefire is because you believe that there are negotiations to be had.
Or you believe that Hamas is already so eroded that
yes,
there's now a void of sorts.
That's something. I hope that's so.
Yeah.
You know, and when that's so, then yeah, absolutely. But all I would say is that who can be against a ceasefire? I mean, it's a ridiculous thing to say. But what I do worry is that ceasefire has become a proxy word for just stop and leave the job half done.
Right.
I mean, personally, what I'd like to see is Netanyahu go.
Yeah.
Replaced by someone like Benny Gantz, who's got military credentials but is sane.
Yes.
And I think would have, unlike Netanyahu, would have a kind of 3 to 4 year plan.
Well, Netanyahu hasn't got a 2 to 3 week plan.
Exactly.
I mean, he's hiding from people like Benny Gantz because they're all saying, well, what is the end of
state? What's the end game?
Where do you want us to get to? And he's literally not taking the meetings.
Yeah, and hostages' families are being very critical of him, and understandably, yeah, which is like, well, how are you getting our people out?
Yeah.
So I think it is, you know, certainly until he goes. I mean, what you really want is Hamas out and Netanyahu out. I mean, that is a result.
That would be progress.
Yeah. That would be progress of a sort. But what I fear is that this is now escalating into a regional conflict and perhaps a international conflict, because you read worrying stories about arrests of jihadi cells all over Europe and in America. Mm. And it is not hard to see this sort of translating into atrocities, which will then be even more divisive.
Totally, but,
you know. So that worries me enormously.
It's clearly absolutely depressingly tragic.
Without
obvious solution.
Sometimes, and this is very hard for people of a liberal mindset to accept. I find it hard to accept. There are things which are just tragic.
Yeah,
it's very difficult, and that's not a reason to give up.
Yeah. No, totally. And you know, you can always minimise tragedy, but it still doesn't stop it being a tragedy.
No, absolutely. And then speaking of apocalypse.
Yeah.
There's a presidential election in Taiwan on January the 13th.
Brilliant.
Hooray! Yeah. And look, I mean, up until now, this year probably, I've always thought, look, you know, China isn't going to blockade Taiwan. Come on.
Mm.
And America has always been able to have this kind of totally inconsistent policy, which is we believe in one China, but if China ever blockades or invades Taiwan, we will respond militarily.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense at all, but it's kind of worked. Everyone's saved face. And now suddenly Beijing's trying to oust the ruling DPP party because they feel are getting a bit too independent, and the incumbent president Tsai Ing-wen has come to the end of a maximum 2 terms. So it's in play. And what's scary is the level of cyber intervention and other forms of intervention by Beijing in this election. It's very tight and no one knows what it's going to lead to. But again, what you have to worry about is imagine a more biddable regime coming in Taiwan, more Beijing friendly. And then imagine a crisis of some sort in America.
Right.
Where if you were Xi Jinping, you'd think, is it ever going to get better?
Yeah.
Let's
just take the moment.
Let's just take the moment. Now,
As Putin did with Ukraine.
Exactly. Now, the one of the slogans in Taiwan at the moment is we don't want to be the second Ukraine or the next Ukraine. Yeah. And you can understand why. And I think that's sort of one of the characteristics of this year, 2024, is that the unthinkable is becoming thinkable, and the levels of volatility are unprecedented. I just don't know. I mean, one hopes the Taiwanese election will go off smoothly. One hopes that when we're having this conversation this time next year, Taiwan will still be in this strange limbo, constitutional limbo it is. But I can't say with any certainty that's the case. And
that is the theme throughout this entire conversation we've just been having, is that the unthinkable is becoming thinkable.
Yes,
you know, across everything.
And I think a lot of bills are finally coming due to be paid. You know, and one of them is, what sort of international order do we want? You know, what kind of UN do we want? But also, what do we want America to do? Because when Biden was elected, he said America is back, and everyone went, "Ray, an end to Trump isolationism." But we've shown repeatedly that we don't really want America to be rampaging across the landscape, you know, fighting forever wars. We don't.
Yeah.
And more to the point, neither do they.
Yeah.
You know, they want NATO to
pay up. And yeah, do
so
their job, yeah.
10 years from now, what does the global security apparatus look like?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. Again,
and we can't, Europeans are very dependent on America for our security.
Too dependent. You know, it's funny, isn't it? Because one thinks of a time not that long ago when the idea of a European army was sort of sacrilegious. But actually now, you have a lot of intelligent people saying, well, you know,
makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Makes a lot of sense. And Germany, which has always shied away from a strong military kind of character for obvious historic reasons, huge pressure.
Well, Trump's right about that in the sense that when he looks at NATO and says, it's an organization we are basically paying for and the Europeans are just getting a lot of the benefit from.
Yeah, and you reserve the right to tell us you hate us.
Yeah, that's right.
When we spend more than you do, and then we go and sort out these issues, and if it lasts more than 3 weeks, you call us imperialists. I mean, it is although, you know, when I hear the Republican debates, the presidential debates, and the kind of who can be the most isolationist, is alarming.
It does get scary because that's in their DNA. You know, if you go back to the founding fathers, that
Washington's
is in their DNA.
Farewell address. You know, was we don't get entangled in, and you're right. It's a relatively recent idea, the Pax Americana, and I think it's in its old form, it's gone. Mm. So the question is, moving forward, you know, what kind of role do we see for NATO, for America? For now, if Trump wins, the answer is practically zero.
Yeah.
And that's scary.
Well, then that does bring the question right into the foreground, and there'll be a solution required because can you imagine a world without a NATO in it now, right now?
John Bolton's memoirs are amazing. I mean, John Bolton, you know, it's amazing Trump's capacity to make crazy people look sane. You know, John Bolton was his national security advisor and, you know, really demented and deranged, but he was like, wow, this guy's off the hook. And in his memoirs, there's a description of sort of being in a car and Trump going, maybe today I'm going to leave NATO, and John Bolton saying, no, don't do that, Mr. President, and calling generals on his phone saying, please text him, you know,
Jesus,
you know,
might do it
today, I'm not sure, you know, NATO, you know, it's kind of, is it a good thing, is it a bad thing?
When I was growing up, you used to look back at 20th century history and think, how lucky am I to be alive now? You know, in the best time there is to be alive.
Totally.
And now I'm slightly worried that we're just on the advent of possibly the worst time to be alive, you know.
Yes, like, and I mean, you know, we've both got kids, right?
Yeah.
And that focuses the mind, doesn't it? You know, it really does, because you think, I mean, one of the kind of natural human instincts is this impulse to leave a better place behind you, you know, a better future, a better prospect, a more peaceful world, all these banalities that actually are very meaningful.
I think maybe people will look back at our generation and the generation before and think we were the generations that absolutely blew it. You know, we had the opportunity to create a much better world, but we absolutely blew it.
I think that the tragedy of the 90s is the subject of a great book by a great historian, you know, which is, we had this moment where we could have reshaped the world as people did after the Second World War.
Yeah.
We could have secured Russia with 100 Marshall plans.
Yes.
And what we did was we said, here's this thing called democracy. Now, what's this about oligarchs and former KGB people taking all the money? All right, you'll be fine. We'll see in 10 years, you know.
It's fine.
And 10 years was Putin, and he's still around.
All right, well, that's been consistent doom and gloom. Is there anything to look forward to in the next 12 months? Apart from Liverpool possibly winning the
Liverpool
title.
Obviously a cause of endless joy. As one of my continuing education as a football fan. The Olympics?
Yes.
The Euros?
Yes.
The Euros, both can...
Lots of good sport, yeah.
Very good sport. I think it may just be sport, you know. I'm not sure that there's much else on the... on the sort of hymn sheet to look forward to.
But you're right, the Olympics will
The Olympics is invariably, and I have a hunch the French will do a fantastic
job. I hope they do,
You know, I mean, Macron will not... I mean, he'll just move heaven and earth, won't he, for it to be like a, you know, grand projet.
It will be his Mitterrand moment.
Yeah. And good luck to him, because we need something like that. And the Olympics do... They have a... I mean, one of the interesting things I think about sport is that it's one of the last things that people trust.
Yeah.
You know, people actually do. One of the reasons that Gary Lineker is such an influential character.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, people trust him a lot more than they do Keir Starmer or Rishi Sunak.
And not to stretch things too much, but it does come back full circle to your points about regularising trust within politics.
Yeah.
Well, the reason people trust sport is that there are very clear rules, you know.
Absolutely.
And they're very well scrutinised, you know. And people moan
about... And managers get sacked.
We need a VAR for politics, don't we?
Yes.
We need people to say, right, stop a minute. What's just happened? Who did what? That's not allowed, mate. You're now in a lot of trouble.
You know, if Michelle Moan was playing in the Prem, right, she'd be 50 yards on offside and say to the ref, oh, it's just offside.
That's right, yeah. I don't own this offside.
No, it's not my, you know, I don't see it's the problem.
It's not my ball.
What, by the way, just for so listeners can know, where are we with Michelle Moan?
So next week, we're going to, in partnership with the Good Law Project, we're going to serve them notice that we're going to sue them to recover the money that we had to spend in our legal response to their empty defamation threats.
And they've been selling, we read that they've been selling off
apparently they're selling the yacht that they don't own. So that's, I don't know where that falls into law. But
Matt, she's just lying to the press, okay?
Yeah, yeah. It's not a crime.
It's not a crime.
It's not a crime.
She's a member of the House of Lords. I mean, it's extraordinary, isn't it, that you've got a member of the House of Lords saying it's not a crime to...
No, just a lie.
Stuff,
yeah. Well, yeah. I've been following closely Dan Needle, the tax lawyer, who's
great man,
who's been threatening for what sounds like some fairly serious evidence against Doug Barrowman.
Excellent.
You know, so there's
who's Mr. Moan.
Yeah, Mr. Moan. Yeah,
yeah.
Who's, you know, the whole premise of this sucks, and this kind of smokescreen that they're trying to put up about, well, we're not quite as bad as a lot of other people, you know, that doesn't really wash. But she's right in that sense that there is a bigger story.
This is a structural story.
Yeah, yeah.
But as I think we said on the end of 2023 episode, you know, she's not a scapegoat, she's a case study.
Yes,
and this idea that she is not a victim. One thing one can be sure of at the beginning of 2024, Michelle Moan is not a victim.
No, no. On that note, thank you so much for listening to our first podcast.
Thank you very much. And I hope you all, in spite of all the above, you and your families have a great year.
Yes, a wonderful year ahead.
And you know, there's probably going to be a change of government in the UK. So it's not it's not all doom and gloom.
So there are Donald Tusk in Poland.
Like,
we can push back against these people.
No, I mean, it's not nothing human agency.
Yeah.
This is why I hate the right side of history argument, right? Which is that the only thing that ever is human agency.
That's right.
People coming together and doing stuff. That's it. That's all there is. And none of what we've been discussing today is inevitable.
No.
The question is, are people prepared to step up to the plate at the various levels of politics and citizenship? And there's only one way to find out, as Harry Hill would say.
Good stuff. Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for listening. Get in any questions and feedback to our email address, which is 2matts, that's the number 2, MATTS, at tnepublishing.com. We look very much forward to hearing your questions for our regular Sunday morning Q&A show.
Q&A, yes.
Yeah, which we'll pick up this Sunday. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And don't forget your subscription offer at theneweuropean.co.uk/2matts. That's the number 2, MATTS. You do something positive about the state of the media in this
country.
That's
something you can do in 2024.
Yeah, you can. Be proactive. Support our journalism. If you like what you hear on this podcast, then subscribe to The New European. There's plenty of it in there every single week. Thank you, as ever, to our production team, Ollie at Rethink Audio. And until next week.
It's goodbye from me.
It's goodbye from him.
Goodbye. Goodbye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.